We need a real investigation. I don't think we have one yet.
Yes, it's true. And yes, it is a crime.
Well, thank you, Cleta Mitchell. Thank you for that explanation. Really interesting and kind of appalling.
Thank you,
really.
Tucker.
Cleta Mitchell is somebody with great courage, and she's involved with your litigation and lawsuits and all of this stuff. She literally gave up her whole practice not to get paid. She saw how corrupt it was, how disgusting it was, how dirty it was. And I want to thank you on behalf of everybody in this room and everybody in this country. You are a hell of a lawyer and tough. And that's what we need.
This is our podcast about all things elections, how elections are run, how they ought to be run, how sometimes they're not run the way they're supposed to be, and what we as citizens can do about it. And this week, we're very blessed to have as our guest, Jason Snead, who is the president of the Honest Elections Project and knows a lot about elections. I think you're going to really enjoy hearing what Jason has to tell you. So, Jason, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Cleta. Thank you for inviting me to be on the show.
Okay. So, Jason, before we start, let's tell everybody a little bit about you, about your background, and then let's talk about the Honest Elections Project and what that's all about. So tell everybody about you.
Sure. Well, I was at the Heritage Foundation before starting HEP. I had the great privilege of working with Ed Meese and the center now named for him, the Meese Center there, with a fantastic group of people, including Hans von Spakovsky and others, working in this issue area, which has always been important. Always been something that has been, you know, intriguing to me personally, but also as the foundation of democracy, I think should be important to every single American. So after my time at Heritage, I started Honest Elections Project to really focus on that and help to move the ball forward, defending election integrity laws across the country. And right now, we have kind of a three-tier strategy, if you will. We do litigation. We do policy work and advocacy, and we also help to develop effective messaging so that we can fight and win in court, we can fight and win in public, and we can ultimately, as we like to say, make it easier to vote and harder to cheat in America.
Well, Jason, you all really have done so much work, and I want to touch on some of the things you've done. Going back to 2021 and all the work that you did, talk a little bit about the message development and some of the things that you and Honest Elections Project did to stop the takeover of our elections by the federal government, what the far left was trying to do, because you were really someone that everybody in Congress and outside of Congress really relied on. So talk a little bit about that message development that you did. And we still do.
Well, that's right. That's right. I mean, this is an interesting fact. If you think, and I know, I strongly suspect the folks listening to your podcast will agree with this. If you think that it's pretty reasonable to show a photo ID when you cast a ballot, you might think that you're in a minority if you listen to the left, right? They're very loud, they're very aggressive, and they can make you feel like you are somehow in the fringe if you think that you should have to show a photo ID to vote. But like I said, I suspect that most of your podcast listeners and viewers feel that you should. And it turns out that actually overwhelmingly Americans agree, right? And in fact, in polling that we did just a few months ago, 84% of people say that you should have to show an ID. And so that is kind of a long way of getting to the root of what we're trying to do, which is develop effective messaging so that the left can't make us silent anymore. That's what they are trying to do. They're very loud. They have lots of slogans. They like to call people racist and, you know, go after people personally. But ultimately, what they're trying to do is silence the vast majority of Americans who have a very common sense perspective about election integrity. And when you tick off a lot of the things, Cleta, that you've been working on for years, that we've been working on, identification laws, clean voter rolls, non-citizen voting bans, it turns out that most Americans are actually on our side. But you wouldn't know that. And so what we wanted to make sure was that we had exactly the right type of messaging so that conservatives could talk about these issues, and also so that conservatives would understand that when they're talking about the importance of securing elections, they're speaking for a lot of people, including overwhelming majorities of minority voters and even Democrats, too. This really is an American issue. It's not just a partisan one. So we do a lot of polling. We do focus groups. and try to find the right ways to talk about this so that you can get led on target, but also so that you can make sure that our policymakers understand that they really are speaking for most people when they're talking about the importance of preserving election integrity.
Well, you know, in that regard, one of the things that I've come to realize very much that I had a suspicion about this, but I hadn't really formulated deep opinions as I now have. But when we talk about showing ID to vote, what I've begun to realize over the last year and a half is that as we have moved further and further away from in-person voting, I've come to believe that it's not hard, it's impossible to verify the identity of people who vote by mail. You know, whether it's signature verification or it's some other form, the volume, the sheer volume of mail ballots coming into the election offices, it's applications and then it's ballots. And I mean, have you done any, and maybe this is a research for next year, but have you done any research about that? And what should we be thinking about that as it relates to, we know people like the idea of a securing our the identity, making sure that person is who he or she says he or she is. What do you think about that? Has Honest Elections Project done any work in that area?
Yeah, so we have, and Cleta, you're spot on. There are a lot of problems when you vote by mail, right? We know, and we've known for a long time, that mail ballots are the least secure way to cast a vote, that they are the tool of choice for people that want to commit fraud. And by the way, fraud is real, as we know. When I was at Heritage, I helped start the voter fraud database, and Hans and others are continuing to add to that all the time. So we know that voter fraud happens. And when you look at the data, when you look at the cases, and you can go on to that Heritage site, I commend it to everybody, heritage.org/voter fraud. You see that almost any time that someone is committing fraud on a scale that affects more than, you know, one or two ballots, it deals with mail ballots because it's so much easier, and you can do it away from the observations of either election workers or election observers. It's just easier to do, right? It's easier to do when it is behind closed doors in someone's home, or it's in a nursing home or something like that. So we have looked at these problems, and you know, there are safeguards and security mechanisms that absolutely need to be deployed. If your state is going to allow any kind of widespread mail voting, or really any kind of mail voting, you know, absentee voting or otherwise, there are some basic things that we think you need to do. One is bring identification requirements to those mail ballots. So you write an ID number in, and that becomes the replacement for signature matching, which is subjective and can be ignored. I mean, we saw what happened in Michigan when the Secretary of State there, Jocelyn Benson, has been trying so hard to effectively neuter her state's requirements that you do signature matching. So we recommend, one, that you replace signature matching with photo ID. We also recommend that you do not automatically distribute ballots to folks. You should have to, at the very least, request a ballot with each election. We recommend that you do good list maintenance to keep voter rolls clean, because you certainly should not be mailing ballots out to folks who may not even be eligible to vote any longer. And you need to have good bans and protections against vote trafficking, which, you know, Cleta, as you know, has been used and abused for years in various places across the country to put activists and operatives, sometimes people on campaign payrolls, or even the candidates themselves, in direct access with voters as they're casting ballots, and then they actually take possession of those ballots without any supervision, which is just absolutely unacceptable. It allows for coercion. It allows for intimidation. It allows for you to destroy ballots. And that has happened, and that has affected the outcome of races. As I like to say, no one's right to vote should be in someone else's hands, but that's exactly what vote trafficking is. So, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. There's a lot that needs to be done and that can be done to secure those votes. But we always have to be mindful of the fact that voting by mail is the most vulnerable to fraud. It's also the most vulnerable to error. It is a problem, and it's something that states, fortunately, are beginning to tackle.
Well, it's interesting because I went yesterday to my county's absentee ballot processing board meeting. The board meets and reviews that, and they come in, they've got this stack of ballots, and the staff has confirmed the identity based on their voter registration number. But that none of that is available for public observation. And they read off the last four digits of the numbers, but they don't even tell you the names. And then the board members can go over and look through, and I'm looking at this pile of ballots that were a nice little stack here, but then the board members are taking things out. And I'm thinking, how, you know, this is one little county in North Carolina. If I were in New York City or Philadelphia or Detroit, I mean, this is a chain of custody nightmare. There's so many touches to those ballots. So anyway, that's something for another day and another fight. I know that Honest Elections Project is going to be essential in trying to help us get states to strengthen their laws on mail voting and verification of identity. But you also mentioned that Honest Elections Project has been engaged in litigation. Talk to us about the litigation, because I know you've been extremely involved and have at least one really great victory and one, you know, I want you to talk about this great victory in Arizona and some of the other things that you've been working on in the litigation space.
So, you know, Clita, as you mentioned earlier, there was this big push in Congress over the past 2 years to try to pass H.R. 1, which was going to essentially take power to regulate elections away from the states and give it to partisan bureaucrats and politicians in Washington. It was a federal takeover of elections. And, you know, through the work that you have done and so many other groups have done, we were able to stop that. But the left does not stop. It doesn't waste time. It's always looking for the next opportunity to change election laws for political advantage. And so they started looking to ballot measures. And in Arizona, there was a multi-million dollar effort to put a 26-page ballot measure on the November ballot this year that would have been essentially H.R. 1 for the state. It would have done just about everything possible and imaginable to weaken election integrity laws and skew election laws in Arizona to favor the left over the right in very partisan ways. And it looked at the time, a couple of months ago at this point, that it was going to actually be put on the ballot. The group that was pushing it to take in millions from national dark money left-wing organizations to gather signatures, They turned in a huge haul of signatures to qualify for the ballot. But we and other organizations, including a new group called Right, Restoring Integrity and Trust in Elections, AFPI, Heritage Action, and others, were able to work with our friends, the Arizona Free Enterprise Club, and actually defeat this thing in court. It was a running fight. It was a two-week nail biter. I don't know if I've ever been more on the edge of my seat as we were waiting on the final ruling from the Arizona Supreme Court. But in the end, we were able to knock off more than half of the signatures that they had turned in and prevent this massive attempt at a left-wing power grab in Arizona from going on the November ballot. And, you know, almost immediately, the group that was pushing this, as well as a lot of folks on the left and a lot of folks in the corporate media, were talking about how ironic it is that groups are talking about saving elections by denying voters the right to choose whether to have these laws and that sort of nonsense. The reality is this, the rules are pretty clear in Arizona about what sort of signatures you have to gather and who you can gather them from. Those rules were not followed. They played fast and loose with elections, hoping that they could put this on. And then they wanted to pour potentially tens of millions of dollars to outright lie to Arizona voters about what was in this so that they could hoodwink them into voting for it. And so I think it was a big victory, not only that we were able to spare Arizona that very ugly fight, but also that we were able to show that the laws that govern the signature gathering process have to be followed. And I don't think in any way, shape, or form, it is out of character to say that the left, if they're playing fast and loose with the rules to get this on the ballot, would play fast and loose with the rules of elections once they rewrote them. So I think this was a great, great victory. But we've also had a few others too. We're in North Carolina right now with a voter list maintenance lawsuit. So we're going to try to get North Carolina to do more to clean up its voter rolls. We had a win on that front in Michigan. We got the Secretary of State to start removing 177,000 outdated registrations from the rolls there. And we pushed back on a collusive settlement in Minnesota between Mark Elias and the Democratic Secretary of State, Steve Simon, and got a very, very strong ruling. This was in 2020 before the election, got a very strong ruling in the Eighth Circuit that held that the Secretary of State cannot rewrite the rules, that they cannot do this in the collusive litigation strategy that Mark Elias likes. And the money quote, from my perspective, is that there's no pandemic exception to the Constitution, which is as true today as it was then.
Oh, that's fabulous. You know, we need to make sure that, you know, because Mark Elias and his vast network of litigation allies on the left and have brought a number of lawsuits, particularly in places where they have Democrat attorneys general, like North Carolina. And North Carolina had a very good law that protected nursing home residents, requiring bipartisan teams to go in if you were going to engage, if you were going to help the residents vote. So you would have a Democrat and Republican so that you couldn't just go in and basically harvest the ballots of unsuspecting elderly people. And so this group that called itself some disabled group filed a lawsuit saying, well, that was a denial of the rights of the disabled. Of course, the attorney general didn't defend it. And the judge, because there were no material disputed facts and the attorney general didn't argue why it should be defended, ruled in favor of the plaintiffs. So now they're free to. And the thing that is so upsetting is what you made a reference to it, but how the left, they misrepresent what things, they say the opposite. It's just so Orwellian. They say, what did they call the Arizona proposition? Was it something like protect our vote or something like that?
It was free and fair elections.
Free and fair elections, right.
Yeah. Vote for this to save democracy and free and fair elections. You're right. They are very good at using words and language to mislead what they're doing.
Well, and so that's what they did with this litigation. And I basically, I think I misrepresented to the court, but of course, nobody calls them on it. They said, well, this is somehow denies rights to the elderly and disabled, when in fact, the law actually protected the elderly and disabled. And speaking of that, talk to us about what they've done in Michigan, because this is a very worrisome situation. So tell everybody what they've done there. And again, using deceptive language.
That's right. This effort in Michigan is exactly like what they tried to do in Arizona. It's exactly what you were just describing, Cleta. There is a ballot measure on the November ballot. So voters in Michigan will have the opportunity to approve or disapprove this in just a few weeks' time, really now, actually, with voting going on already.
Yeah.
It's called Promote the Vote, and it is a constitutional amendment which would enshrine in the state's constitution a series of left-wing policy and agenda priorities. Number one, it would ban photo identification requirements in the state of Michigan. And to your point about the clever use of language and the way that they strategically engage on this, they are taking existing Michigan law and putting it in the constitution. Now, why are they doing that? Because existing Michigan law says you can ask a voter to show a photo ID, but you cannot require them to show it. If they don't want to, then they can sign an affidavit, essentially just a statement saying, you know, I am who I say I am, and then they can vote. They're doing it this way so that they can say that they are defending and preserving the state's voter ID law. In actuality, what they're trying to do is prevent the legislature from adopting Secure My Vote, which is another initiative that over 500,000 Michigan voters actually signed up for, that would create true photo identification requirements in Michigan. So this is an attempt to prevent that by putting this bad law in the state's constitution. So number one, Promote the Vote bans photo ID requirements in Michigan by putting it in the constitution. Number two, it creates a constitutional right to Zuck Bucks. So from now on, Michigan will actually have in its constitution language that says that billionaires and special interests can directly fund the administration of elections. And other than those offices having to disclose that they are receiving funds, there are no other checks. There are no other oversight or accountability mechanisms. You just get the money and then you can spend it. It's a repeat of the 2020 strategy. Michigan will be wide open to Zuck Bucks. And I know that your listeners have heard about the problems with Zuck Bucks before, so I won't dive too deeply into that. But that will be put in the Michigan Constitution if this goes through. Another thing that this Promote the Vote measure does is juice mail voting. So from now on, there will be a permanent mail voter list. And once voters request an absentee ballot and get on that list, they will receive a mail ballot every single election, whether they want one or not, until they have not voted in the state of Michigan for 6 years, right? Wow. So once you get on that list, you basically do not come off unless you ask to be removed or you don't vote at all for 6 years. That means that we know for sure, because of problems with the constant churn, people are moving, they pass away, they become disqualified to vote. We know that ballots in Michigan are going to go to people who are not qualified and eligible to vote if this passes. That's what's going to be happening. But they're trying to shift the state to mail voting. And they're also, of course, getting rid of the requirement, even that you put a postage stamp on this, it's all going to be prepaid. They're also massively expanding drop boxes in the state. So you're going to have one drop box per 15,000 registered voters in the state of Michigan. And they have to be available 24 hours a day for 40 days.
Oh,
there is
my.
No requirement that these be secured other than that you call them secure. There's no monitoring. There's no staffing. And like I said, there's certainly no requirements that they only be available during, for instance, business hours. So they're clearly trying to drive up the use of mail voting. They're trying to put these insecure drop boxes throughout the state, which raises all sorts of problems and concerns, including vote trafficking and problems with chain of custody. And they are banning the use of ID for these ballots as well. So you're only going to be able to use signatures. And keep in mind, as I mentioned before, Jocelyn Benson is trying hard to weaken that so badly that if someone, Cleta, were to sign your ballot for you, as long as they got one letter in this phony signature right that matches your name, it would be counted as a legitimate signature on the ballot. That's how weak that new rule would be. And then the last thing I'll mention here is that it creates new opportunities for Mark Elias to sue the state and continue to try to twist and manipulate election laws in Michigan for partisan and political advantage. So this is going to leave the state wide open to expensive, costly, partisan lawsuits. So this is really the beginning, not the end of the story if this measure passes. It really is all about gutting election integrity, eliminating photo identification requirements once and for all, and pushing Michigan as hard as possible to become a vote-by-mail state.
Well, what's interesting about it, though, is that they're not saying that in their advertising. I mean, in the ballot description, the ballot title. I mean, aren't they making it sound as though that they're, look at just the name of it, Protect the Vote? It's doing anything but that.
That's right. That's right. In fact, if you show up in a Michigan voting booth and you read the ballot language and that explains what this is, if you've never heard of this before, I suspect that a lot of conservatives would be inclined to vote for it. Because what does the language say? It says this number one protects the fundamental right to vote, which everyone believes we should be protecting.
Which
it helps
agree
make
with.
Sure
we agree
it,
with.
Exactly. Exactly. It says that it makes sure that military ballots are going to be counted, which again, everyone across the board wants the military when they're deployed overseas to be able to vote. It creates 9 days of early voting, which is something that we see in our polling is very popular, even with conservatives. And on the photo ID front, it says it allows for you to verify identity by showing a photo ID or signing a statement. And the problem with that is that particularly on the right, they will read that statement. They will see the words photo ID. They will think this is good. And then they'll be more inclined to vote for it. So it really is a deceptive, misleading campaign. And they are pushing this message hard that if you promote the vote, you are voting to secure Michigan elections. You are voting for election integrity. They are trying to co-opt the language that we have used on the right to talk about these initiatives because they know that photo ID is so popular that if they run out and actually tell the truth about what they're doing, they're going to lose and they're going to lose massively. So they would rather lie about this and win. And the problem, of course, is that if folks go along with this, if they don't know what's in this, then they might wake up the day after Election Day and realize that they have inadvertently eliminated photo ID requirements in Michigan for all time.
Well, I sure hope that we can get this word out to as many people as possible because I know that there was an effort there was an administrative proceeding where the it was challenged. Tell us what procedurally happened and then what the Michigan Supreme Court did.
So the Board of Canvassers in Michigan was considering the language and the promote the vote measure before it was going to actually be officially certified and put on the ballot. And the Board of Canvassers actually deadlocked in its vote 2-2, with the two Republican members voting not to certify the measure and the two Democrats voting to certify it. Now, believe it or not, a tie actually is a win because it's not a vote to certify the measure. So the measure was not going to be on the November ballot, but promote the vote filed a motion in the Michigan Supreme Court. And the Michigan Supreme Court ultimately overturned the decision of the Board of Canvassers, and really on party line votes, if you look at the disposition of justices, voted to put this, as well as Proposition 3, the abortion on demand measure, on the November ballot. So there were some very serious arguments that had been made at the Board of Canvassers and in the Michigan Supreme Court that the ballot language that was described to voters when they were signing petitions to put this thing on did not actually contain all of the changes to the state's constitution, that they had overlooked some things, they had left some things out, and that should matter. Voters should know what they're signing. But unfortunately, the Michigan Supreme Court gave us a very politicized ruling and ultimately put this on the ballot. It
was so discouraging, but we hope that anybody who is within the sound of our voices who is in Michigan, or if you know anyone in Michigan, please tell them to vote no. What is it, Proposition 2? Is it number 2?
Yeah, it's Proposition 2. And, you know, really, it is so important for folks to educate themselves on what's in this and then be spreading the word as far and wide as they can about what is actually going on here. Because, as I said, if we wait until people get into the voting booth, confident that they'll read the description and then, you know, make a decision there, that description has been crafted in a way which is as misleading as the Promote the Vote campaign. So we need to be talking to folks in the grassroots. We need to be writing letters to the editor. We need to be talking to neighbors, making sure that at the very least folks know what they're voting for. And if they want to vote to get rid of photo ID, I can't tell them not to, but I do think that they should know what is actually in this. And it's, of course, not just photo ID. It's Zuckbox. It's juicing mail voting. It's all of these sorts of things. But they should know at the very least what's actually in this before they cast a vote.
Well, and you remember you and I talked earlier this week with someone who has been trying to alert people by doing Facebook Live broadcast or whatever you call it, but a Facebook Live events. And those are being blocked by Facebook. So they're not able to post ads or not able to do Facebook Live meetings and let people know about what's really in this. And of course, the propaganda media in Michigan is not on our side on anything, including this. So it's an uphill battle, but thanks for all your hard work on it. Tell us about some of the other ballot issues that our voters in different states are going to be looking at with regard to elections. There are a couple of interesting other state ballot issues, right?
There are. So I'll tick off a couple here. And there are some ballot measures that kind of cut both ways, right? So there are some from the left and there are some from the right. And since we were talking about Michigan, I'll stick with the theme of ballot measures from the left and touch on Nevada. Nevada has a measure which is called Question 3, and it would bring ranked choice voting to the state for all.
Ranked choice voting. Ranked choice voting.
Yes. Yeah. For your listeners, if they don't know, ranked choice voting replaces traditional elections where you vote for one person with a system where you can vote for potentially as many candidates as there are running for an office, and you rank order them. So, you know, you pick if we were both running, Cleta, you know, your listeners would put Cleta as number one, and then, you know, Jason is number two, and so on in terms of the order of candidates that they want. And so then all of these ballots are taken in and officials run the numbers, and the lowest performing candidate, if no one gets a clear majority, 50+1 majority, the lowest performing candidate gets disqualified and removed from the race. And the people who voted for them, their ballots get redistributed by looking to their second choice. So whoever they list number two gets their vote instead. That continues until you get to someone who has over 50% of the remaining vote. And I say that because even though people who push ranked choice voting say it guarantees majority rule, it actually doesn't. And you can see that even in the recent Alaska special congressional election. So many ballots were thrown out that Mary Peltola won that race with a plurality of the total votes cast, but not a majority of the total votes cast. And that problem of ballots getting thrown out is called ballot exhaustion. So it means if someone votes for you and you get disqualified, if they don't vote for someone else, that ballot also gets thrown out. So it's as good as not voting at all. It really is voter disenfranchisement. It's a complex scheme. Millions upon millions of dollars from the left are pouring into states like Nevada, like Missouri, trying to get this done. It's on the ballot in Nevada. If it passes this time, it'll be back in 2 years, and then it gets adopted for all statewide legislative and congressional races in Nevada. So that's question three in Nevada. In Connecticut, there's a measure called question one that would allow the legislature in that state to create early voting. Their state constitution actually says you can't do that. So they're running a constitutional amendment there to create early voting. And then in terms of ballot measures that are coming from the right, there's a very important measure in Arizona, Arizonans for Voter ID. This would create uniform standards that universally apply across all ballots cast in person or by mail in the state of Arizona, which is crucially important from a policy perspective, because most people in Arizona vote by mail. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have an ID requirement for mail voting, then, you know, the exception has become functionally the rule there. So this would require that folks write a driver's license or a state ID on the ballot or a last four of a social. It makes IDs free for anyone who needs them for voting purposes. And it also provides for true photo ID requirements for in-person voting. That's Arizonans for Voter ID. Proposition 309 is the number there. Nebraska also has a photo ID requirement. That's Initiative 432. Ohio has a non-citizen voting ban on the ballot this November. That's issue two. There are, as we know, lots and lots of jurisdictions, localities, municipalities across the country that are trying to enfranchise non-citizens. New York City is the most infamous of these, trying to give the vote to 800,000 non-citizens. As long as you've been in the city for 30 days, you could be a foreign national, you can be, you know, a journalist for one of the Chinese Communist Party newspapers, whatever, you could vote in New York City elections. This problem is happening more and more. Some states are starting to ban it by actively changing their constitutional language so that instead of saying every citizen, they say only citizens can vote. Ohio has this on the ballot in November. It's called Issue 2. And in December, Louisiana will have this on a ballot measure as well, called Amendment 1 there. And then the last one that I'll mention, Cleta, is Massachusetts. They have question 4. Massachusetts has a referendum on a law that was passed over a gubernatorial veto that allows for for illegal aliens to get driver's licenses. So it actually removes the citizenship and immigration process in Massachusetts. Now, why is that relevant to a discussion about elections? Because Massachusetts also has automatic voter registration.
Oh, my.
So even though the law says, the text of the law says that the Secretary of State has to develop procedures to prevent the folks that are not providing appropriate documentation for citizenship and immigration status so that they do not get registered to vote, you have to have a lot of faith in the Secretary of State and the DMV in order to get that done, especially given the fact that the law says that you can't keep records about who has and has not provided this. So if someone does get a driver's license, is an illegal alien, there's a fair degree of likelihood that they could get registered to vote, and then it would be very difficult to identify after the fact. So that's a referendum to repeal that law. It's called Question 4. And it's a little bit of a, you know, it's not immediately apparent that it's relevant to election integrity, but there is that automatic voter registration connection, and I wanted to flag that as well.
Oh, my goodness. The left never stops, do they, Jason?
No, they don't.
They never stop. Well, I think the Honest Elections Project has a very busy future ahead, but fighting all of these things. But you know, you have had some great successes. And that's really, you know, there was a time when we really didn't have the Honest Elections Project. And so a lot of these things slipped by, like in Alaska. the ranked choice voting. And I think there's a lot of voters remorse in Alaska. What can be done to what can Alaska do to rid itself of that? Was that a constitutional amendment? Do they have to pass another constitutional amendment? What would be necessary to get rid of rigged choice voting in Alaska?
My understanding of the way that this works in Alaska is that there is a 2-year shot clock on changing laws that have been adopted through the citizen initiative process. So this was adopted in 2020. That means that the protected period ends at the end of this year. And so my sense is that this could be repealed in Alaska, and certainly given the problems that they've run into, given voter confusion, given the fact that voters have at least anecdotally decided not to vote because of the complexity. And that's a phenomenon that even some of ranked choice voting's biggest proponents, like Fair Vote, acknowledge that people can just get, concerned with the complexity and decide not to vote. I think that there would be an interest and an appetite in trying to do that and get back to a simple, straightforward election system where you go to the voting booth and you pick your candidate, and then you run the numbers that way. I just don't think that RCB is going to do what its proponents say. And that's one way that you can tackle this. But of course, the best way to tackle that is to just not let it come to your state at all. And that's happening more and more.
Well, and you were very involved, I think, in helping to keep it off the ballot in Missouri, right?
Well, actually, that was a really interesting thing. We were looking very closely at that. Millions of dollars had flowed in to that state, or should be poured into that state to gather signatures. And they, in the end, turned in so few signatures that they didn't meet the threshold to qualify for the ballot. So despite a multi-million dollar effort from the left to get it on the ballot in Missouri, it imploded under the weight of its own confusion and complexity. The more that people learn about ranked choice voting, the less they like it. And in fact, you can see that in some of the polling in this Nevada race, where over the course of the last couple of months, the trend lines are pointing in the wrong direction from the perspective of RCB. So Nevada voters have gone from favoring it to disfavoring it in the span of the last month or so.
Oh, that's great news. Well, we hope that goes down in Nevada. We hope the Connecticut measure fails. We hope the Massachusetts measure fails. And we really hope the Michigan Prop 2 fails. That's really very scary. So, Jason, you do such great work. And everybody in the election integrity movement is so appreciative of all that you do and all your leadership. So I just want to thank you for everything that you do, everything you've done, and I know everything you're going to do in the next couple of years. I'm going to thank you in advance because you're a real star, and we all appreciate you so much. And appreciate so much you're taking time to explain some of these things to everybody. And we'll want to get this out so the people in the affected states will know what they should do about these ballot issues. So thanks for all you do. We appreciate you. And that concludes this episode of Who's Counting. We hope that you will share this episode with people, particularly in those states, in Michigan, and Nevada, Connecticut, and Massachusetts, and share and subscribe to the podcast. Big Tech likes to cancel us, and we've been warned by YouTube at least twice now because they didn't like some of the things my guests have said, but the truth will prevail, and it will prevail with all of your help. So we appreciate everybody. We hope if you have not already signed up to be a poll watcher or poll worker, be sure and go to our website, whoscounting.us, and sign up. It's not too late. Get trained, get deployed, help put an eye on every ballot and every ballot envelope everywhere in America. And with that, we thank you for joining us, and hope you'll come back and see us again next week. Thank you. Thank you for listening to Who's Counting. The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Conservative Partnership Institute's Election Integrity Network. It is filmed and recorded at CPI Studios in Washington, D.C. Help us grow this show by sharing this episode with a friend, and be sure to subscribe and to give us a good review. We need your word of mouth because big tech can't be trusted and tries to cancel us daily. Help fight back by visiting whoscounting.us and sign up for this podcast, for our newsletter, become part of the Election Integrity Network.